Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Our underwriters for Art in the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum, regional art patron Mary Levan, and our landlord, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. Thank you for your generous support. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager, and Tom Maloney, vice president of radio operations at Lakeshore Public Radio. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's Breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or through our Facebook page. And next on Art in the Air Spotlight, we have someone who is, well, no stranger to us, Tim King from the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra. And they've been very busy with a lot of things, but they're going to talk about what's coming up in this holiday season, the holiday concert. Tim, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about what you got coming up. I know you just finished your concert with the American Songbook.
Right.
And I think that was all virtual.
We had a small audience for that one, fortunately, and virtual as well. With the recent developments with the pandemic in Indiana, we had to actually apply to the health department to even have this concert, period. So what they've done for us is they've allowed us, we're only allowed to have the orchestra and any members that are there to support the orchestra, like the sound people, the lighting people. And that's it. We cannot have an audience, unfortunately, for this. As you know, Holiday at the Pops has been a fundraiser for the past 25 years. So this is the 26th year, of course, the first time we're ever going to have virtual. and it's December the 12th, Saturday, December the 12th at 7 p.m. Central Time. And what we've done is we've set up a pay-per-view on our website, lcso.net. And it's $20 for the pay-per-view. And of course, that's per household. That's not just per person. So if you've got six people in your household, all six people can view the concert for $20, which is going to be a lot less expensive if you were to go to the concert. We're hoping that a lot of people will take advantage of this because, number one, as far as I know, we're the only orchestra in Indiana that's playing. I did a big research and Muncie's not, Lafayette's not, NISO's not, Indy's not, you know, South Bend isn't. So we're it. And so I'm hoping that people will appreciate the fact that we're going to try to have some live music for them. Chuck Steck, who's our interim music director, is going to be conducting for us. And he's been doing it for many years. He does a great job. So the plan is to have that on our website at lcso.net. And you can, there's a space on there. You can go on and get it now if you want to, and they'll give you an access code so that when it happens that night, you can just type in the access code and then it'll be available to you. Then in addition to that, if you can't tune in that evening, we're going to make it available until the New Year's Day. So for instance, if you're busy Saturday night, the 12th, and you can't see it, you can opt to tune in at a later time and later day. So if you want to have some background music while you're opening presents on Christmas Day or something like that, you can do that. You can just tune in and have that live music for you there.
Can they use their access code more than once if they view it while it's happening and then want to review it? Is that a possibility?
I don't think so. I think you have to pay each time you see it. I'll check into that, Esther, but I think it's per time. But what this concert is going to do for us, it's going to put some funds in to what we call the New Generations Initiative. And the New Generations Initiative for the orchestra is to involve more young people with the orchestra. And so in our orchestra ranks for December the 12th, we're going to have 6 high school student apprentices that are going to be part of the orchestra. Let me look here. Bassoon, clarinet, piano, percussion, trumpet, and violin. And these are all people that are extraordinarily good on their instruments, but they're actually going to be a part of our orchestra, and they're going to be paid along with our orchestra to be a part of it. I think it's going to be a wonderful opportunity for these young people to get to sit beside their mentors in the orchestra there.
Fabulous.
On top of that, we've been partnering with a nonprofit organization called Drew's Gift of Music, and I've talked with you all about this before, where out of Plymouth and Knox, and they take in instruments and they refurbish them. And one of our soloists is actually a student apprentice. His name is Jacob King on trumpet, and he is going to be performing a solo with the orchestra on a Drew's Gift instrument.
Wow.
It's a Stradivarius. Somebody loaned it. I mean, it's donated. It's quite fine. And so you're going to be able to see this whole Drew's Gift in action.
That's wonderful.
That's a great program.
So, Tim, is the orchestra going to be all together, or will they be split on different levels again?
They will be on different. You know, what enables us here is the Civic Auditorium is so big that we are able to spread out. So we were able to have the November concert, and that we were able to work out all of our bugs because we had to completely redo the sound and completely redo the lighting. Half of the orchestra is going to be on the floor, and the other half is going to be up on the stage. So our winds and brass are going to be on the stage, and our strings and harp are going to be on the floor.
Who's the conductor for that one?
Chuck Steck, who's our interim music director and our principal trumpeter.
And we've had him on the show and interviewed him and everything. Had a great interview with him. So what's coming up for 2021?
2021, we have 2 more concerts for this season. March the 14th is the Dr. Wilbur Lynn, who we were supposed to get in last year, with Beethoven 7 and Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And then our final concert is April the 17th with Gary Wado, who is a LaPorte native, but a conductor of national renown that we've never had back. And so he's going to be conducting the orchestra in a long overdue homecoming.
Excellent. Well, this is Tim King with the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra talking about Holiday Pops, which will be coming up on Saturday, December 12th. And you can go online and all through there. Thanks so much for coming on Art in the Air, Tim. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, always
It's always a pleasure to be with you, too. Thank you.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And we're pleased to welcome to Art on the Air Ann Davis. She's the head of production, unfortunately right now furloughed at Theater at the Center. She's been there since 2001. She's worked up from shop all the way to being the head of production, working on all the productions there. And of course, I have an affinity for that because I worked there for 6 years myself as the theater administrator for the building and production manager, lighting designer, and whatever else for the thing. Ann, welcome to Art on the Air.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you, Esther. Thank you, Larry.
Oh, we're so glad to have you. So tell us a little bit about our background for our audience, how you got from where you were to where you are, where you grew up, where you went to school, and how you got to the center.
Oh, sure. My dad moved around quite a bit as I was when we were young. We lived in Guam. He ran hospitals, interestingly enough, and so we moved from place to place. And really, I had always drawn. I was always interested in those things, and I would help my dad with little things, you know, in his shop. Everywhere we moved, he built a house. He, you know, so he came up through the trades, and then he went to Vietnam, and then he went to school. And I, watching him, a lot of those things rubbed off on me. So long story short, I went to college. I got a degree in industrial technology with a focus in road and building construction and a minor in art because I loved artwork and I still do. But it wasn't, I knew it was not going to be enough after, you know, doing some things like, you know, working for IDOT and collecting, you know, do whatever it was, whatever information they needed, you know, I did that multiple summers and then looked at having a job with them. And it just wasn't what I was interested in doing. And I came across theater. I had always loved theater since I'd been old enough to see productions. And I worked a summer music theater just on a whim. And not only was it a great education in what that takes, you know, it's a nonstop schedule, 7 in the morning until like, you know, 10 at night. And one of the professors there noted that I had good paint skills, and I submitted a portfolio to him, and he asked me to be one of their MFA candidates in the fall. And I got in with an assistantship. And when that was over, I went to work for a local TV station, and then I moved to the city shortly after that because sitting on my behind was not what I wanted to do. So
were you involved with theater at all during high school?
No, I was actually super quiet. And I used to carry these sketchbooks with me where I'd like write on one page and then I'd draw on the other page. And I hated high school, mostly because I was such a quiet kid. And I actually finished early and I started junior college while I was finishing high school. And it was there that I really got my first taste of theater. I went to one of the productions at the College of DuPage, and I remember being so excited at the end. I didn't even wait for everybody else to stop clapping. I stood up, you know, and I was clapping, and I probably embarrassed the person I was with, but I just thought, wow, what a great vehicle to, you know, to share stories and to share truths that we feel are common. That's what I love about it.
I know my.
And so how did you feel about those first sets then? So everybody comes at it from a different perspective. You know, the people who have that theater acting are looking at the actors, but I'm behind the scenes. So I notice the backdrops, the furniture, the costumes. Is that it? So do you remember that first play? And, you know, what was it?
You know, actually, I had little tangential experiences with theater before then, but not like that. No, it really... Now I notice those things, and because I'm detail oriented, whatever I am focusing on at the minute, I try to make it as good as I possibly can, you know, even if it's a friendship, for example. But it was the material. I was just so amazed that you could do this in a live space, you know, and have this environment. And to this day, whether it's children's theater or, you know, dance, it's the most live form of art, and it reaches out and it just contacts you directly. You know, it really is. As much as I am a very quiet person and non-sociable and the worst at marketing myself ever in any way at all, I love people and I love our stories. So it's the stories. I'd love to say it's all that visual stuff, which I adore. It's the message every time.
Yeah. I know my first experience was in school with theater, and doing a production of Carousel, which is still close to my heart, with the and that whole thing coming out. And I never thought about making a career because I always thought I was going to go into electrical engineering and everything. But I finally, and actually my degree and my master's are also actually more communications, broadcasting. It wasn't until I did my doctorate that I did theater. But yeah, there's something about that magical experience that kind of ignites it. And then after that, you're just hooked. And I mean, I also did theater while I was going to college with local productions and everything. You were doing things for transportation. What other projects did you do before you came to theater at the center?
I worked for a landscape architect for a little bit. And that was fun because I learned a lot about plants and things like that. Still loved a garden. When I moved to the city, I also worked for a person that had a business that ran historic preservation projects. And what I did for him was I got certified to do restorative stonework. So like capitals and things like that you see on the exterior of limestone homes, things of that nature. You would excise the stuff that really needed to be repaired. And then you would create templates in order to reproduce what had been there, you know, by the existing matching architecture on the other sides. So, I mean, it really is somewhat like stone carving, but it's a little bit easier, obviously, because you're dealing with a softer material and you build it up and then you refine it. So I did that for a little while, a lot of paint, that kind of stuff. And then I started propping in Chicago and I painted at Chicago Scenic Studios. I went on paint calls at places like Steppenwolf, you name it. And of course, you know, I worked the little storefront theaters too. I did whatever came across my path. And, you know, through that over the years, I've definitely learned the art of saying no, but I taught scenic painting at a college level, and you know, I taught at UIC for a couple of semesters until my job became bigger, you know, and I didn't have it in me to do the back and forth anymore, you know. It became, as we branched out with theater, it became easier for me to do that as a group, but it was very, very hard with the mounting responsibility to do those things on my own.
Right. And so then what brought you to Theater at the Center?
I was called in as a painter. And so for the next 4 or 5 years, I worked at DePaul actually for 2 years as a technical assistant. I did everything from, you know, help with light hangs and scenic builds and stuff like that, with, you know, help with their rentals and stuff. And then I went to work in Munster because I really, how do I say this? I guess I kind of like the school of hard knocks. I would prefer to be in the midst of it, even if I have learning to do. And I'm at that point again in my life. You know, I'm going to be doing more of that now. And I loved the place and I loved everything it had to offer. And when I got the chance to make it, you know, help it grow myself, I completely threw myself into that.
Yeah, it's an interesting building. And, you know, it was actually more designed as a recital hall. And I don't know if you know, the shop that's underneath the stage was originally supposed to be the symphony's rehearsal space. And
I know.
I mean, it was never really designed as a shop. And then you build stuff and have to take it out that one set of double doors and beam it up. I mean, that was just really crazy. And there's no loading dock door. That's the other crazy thing.
Well, we have there's an offsite shop that we were building everything in and bringing it in after a while because things grew and because we were doing other projects. But yeah, the no loading dock door, everything had to be broken down in AutoCAD so that it could come in through a set of double doors. And we did a project for Windy City. I got so good at breaking things down in a little bit. It was a whole house. It was, we loaded it in downtown. It was like a 2 or 3 degree day. The shop brought it down there. And there was only one wall out of something like 80 walls this was a house size thing.
Yeah.
You know, it was like the size of 7 semis type of a deal. But we got pretty good at not making mistakes. And when we did make mistakes, fixing them super fast. But all thanks to that no loading dock door. Yes, sir.
Yeah. I can empathize though. When I was there, we did all the builds downstairs and I was always worried about the beam up, you know. It's like, and of course when I was there, we closed the show on Sunday and started rehearsal at 1 o'clock, and the director at the time expected it to be done. And that was always a miracle.
Well, maybe you could take us through what the process is like for you. So maybe from, would it be the script or the, you know, where do you come into it in the process and what is your process like?
Sure. I can go through that 2 different ways. Number one, when working with a group as a production manager and technical director, you're there to guide the production meeting. You're there before that to help with the yearly fiscal budget so that you know exactly how things need to stay on track. And you keep that in mind when you go into that meeting. And I just put that in my back pocket. In any production meeting, we begin with the script. And by the time of the first production meeting, the set designer, the lighting designer, the costume designer, all entities have read the script. And by that first production meeting, typically the scenic and the costume designer would have a pretty good idea of where they were going to go because they've already met with the director, you know, so we're not wasting each other's time. And we have kind of a mini preliminary show and tell. And on that day, as a production manager, I would ask for, you know, copies of those sketches, because at that point, I would do a rough estimate using Excel. I've got a full document that breaks down labor and materials and all those things, paint, everything, you know, because everything takes time and it takes money. So I try to be honest early on. If I see something that isn't going to, if we're not able to produce that vision safely and to equity standards, because Theater at the Center, you know, when it was open, was an equity house, which means, you know, everything has to go in line with OSHA requirements, all those things. And we've got a union we have to report to. So it was just a no-brainer. You want everybody to feel safe. And if I can't produce something to those standards, I will say it, you know. And because we did have a smaller budget than some of the bigger theaters, we wanted to produce content at a high level of artistic, you know, we wanted it to feel as professional as possible, but I also never wanted to say, hey, we can do this if we can't. So do an estimate. Everybody comes back together. Usually that next meeting, the designer would have a model or would have a 3D drawing of some kind. You know, and more concepts would be developed. And at that point, the lighting designer steps in and begins to, you know, we begin to work all that out and talk about where we might want to hide speakers. And typically the process starts about 6 months before. You get everybody hired. You go ahead, you do contracts, things of that nature. And 3 months in, those meetings are really going to start. Usually 4 months, then 3 months, things are due. And a good build would usually take, I'd say, probably a total of 2 to 3 weeks. And then on the install, you try to load in 2 days or whatever it is. We have a season rep plot that lighting designers were welcome to use. We actually just replaced all of our lights with LEDs literally a year ago. So all these incredible lights are hanging in the air, all sad. So because
they're just waiting.
Yeah, exactly. We were doing like 35 special events a year. So that also is part of that production meeting process, because you know you're going to have a set on top of something that's going to need to be used for events and things like that. So you have to consider, does part of this set have to move? How will this interact if I have, let's say, a place like ArcelorMittal come in and they need a projection screen? Because I was responsible for all those things. So it was dovetailing the space as well as aesthetics. And really, too, thinking about audience safety, you know, all of our systems went digital in order to be able to produce theater and events and rentals on that level. And that was part of the meeting. You know, I would always have to be thinking, okay, so if the scenic designer wants to do this, this, and this, and he wants a boat dock downstage, that's going to mean when we have the kids show in April, that's not going to work, you know. So, and it's about respecting and mitigating those issues so that it's not a fight. It's how do we do this the best way possible so that all entities are always happy and the only one cursing is me on my way home at 12 midnight, you know?
It's really important for everybody to hear this aspect of it, because all the audience usually gets is the magic of the moment, and you don't realize the toil that goes into those moments. So
yeah.
And also, there's so many people interested in these careers. So thank you for talking about the process.
And Anne, I can really empathize with those issues from another perspective at the same place.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Many things were not planned very much. It's like, oh, we're going to do this thing now. Like, wait a minute, we can't.
Thank goodness. We were actually at a really really great spot. We all worked really well together on all of those things. And truly, in the beginning, the mistakes that were made are, especially the ones that I made, are unforgettable. Like, you don't ever want to do something wrong like that twice, you know? So yeah, it was a lot of learning how to respect others, especially when you're under stress and tension. Part of the process when you're in a full-blown production area where we actually had a full-time costume shop, we got to the point where we were able to keep things going, is really being able to talk to one another and voice concerns. And even when things have been agreed on, often you have glitches and people get stressed out, and you need to be open and realize that all these emotions that come up while creating anything, even if it's a business plan, are normal human things, and let people work their way through it and get back to progress. That's what we do.
Yeah, and you're working with creative people, and yet you need to make things happen, like on a schedule within a plan. And sometimes creative people don't get that. It's a kind of a diametrically opposed thing. I say, I want to be creative, but theater has to be collaborative. It's the most collaborative of all the arts.
It is. It is, yeah.
And you spend so many hours together that you have to have that good communication, because you're tired, you're overworked. Very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And you want to walk away feeling like, I don't know, you want to walk away feeling like you did something as a group, you know? That's, I hate to say it, but that's what I walked away with in the end was, hey, these were my people, you know?
Right. Do you have a favorite show? Either musical, you know, I'm a musical theater guy, so 90% of what I've done, either directing or I prefer lighting, is musicals. But do you have a favorite show that you like?
Oh, boy. That's a rough question. I can find something good in almost anything. I've seen some terrible theater that I've thoroughly enjoyed. I don't know. You know what? I saw a show that I really loved when early on, and it was called Sight Unseen. And that was actually a straight play. It was beautiful. But I love musicals. I've been lucky to work on some really small stuff. And to be honest, my most favorite project was probably one of the very smallest. And it was with a woman named Cheryl Bruce from Chicago, Cheryl Lynn Bruce. She's a Chicago actress. And it was basically for kids. It was a summer-long project in the Dearborn Projects. And it was amazing because at the end of the summer, you didn't think those kids were going to pull it together. And, you know, we did everything from the lighting to the props and teaching the kids how to use them. And it was the most, honestly, one of the most rewarding things I've ever done, other than fabricating handrails to put in the theater so that older people could lean on them as they were going downstairs. You know, I love the socially responsible aspect of what we do in theater.
So, Anne, do you ever get a chance to do set design or I know from a production background, you probably are saying, well, no, that's not possible, but this is. So in effect, you are helping with the design, but do you design sets as well?
I do. Thank you for asking. Yeah, I do. I have a master's degree in scenic design, and I just always felt like you should know how to build what you draw and that it should always be an extension of joy. I've designed for operas. I've, you know, done musical theater and plays, and I've done tiny shows where, you know, you're the person putting them together. And I love all of it. I love all of it. I only want to do things that can be done as well as I can do them. So I try not to fritter away my energy anymore, because I know that our time on earth is limited, you know, and I want to be the best person I can, and I want to put the best product out there.
So then, to riff on like that first question, how do you bring, when you get a script, how do you yourself bring a freshness to an established show then? When you get that script, are you, I don't know, I guess, yeah. I'm wondering just about the whole art process for you, because when you get the script, all of a sudden, does that design pop into your head? Do you research how it's been done before?
Yeah, I do all of that. And typically it starts with a combination of things, the space itself that you're working in, the budget. So the volume of your message via set design all comes from those places. And if all you have is enough for a chair, that better be a fantastic chair with a powerful message. You know, and if you have a bigger budget, then you get to be a little less determined about what you're trying to say. So what I do is I'll take a look at how something has been done after I've read the script. Because when I first read a script, I do get a couple of images in my head. And what I notice is that image changes. I have a very bad sense of direction. And this is proven to me after I've been in a place, I have to see it like 10 or 12 times and it appears completely different to me. So I guess the ideas of how things spatially occur, it takes several readings, it takes several sketches, and then meeting with the director and the other designers and really refining that to a point where it speaks to everybody, it meets everyone's needs. But typically I have no problem seeing what I'd like something to be, even if it's three or four different ways of seeing it. It's kind of like moving in. You get the idea, you move in, you start to see it more fully. That's how I see
things around. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
So, Anne, right now, tell us a little bit about Theater at the Center is on hiatus, so I guess you're furloughed. So, what are some of the things you're doing with the COVID-19 that's kind of impacted you personally and professionally?
Well, so first off, I fixed all of the windows on our house because we live in a house that was built in 1942. And so I pulled them all and I restored them. And now we have windows that were set to go. So that included fabricating windowsills and doing things like that, you know, for the first couple months, because we didn't think it was going to be that long. And so we got some stuff done. And I'm working on a children's book with my friend Michael Latour, and he's found a publisher for it. So we're working steadily on that. There were some projects before this all happened that the shop typically would have done. And one of them is a project that a good friend, he's basically, he needs to be pulling in revenue for the city and the school district and all that. So I've helped him flip a room essentially into a television studio. And the shop had provided a set. I had drawn up the room itself, and he had union carpenters build that last year. He's got all the equipment in there now, and I've gone in and, you know, painted everything and basically done a mural that is full of 60 tiles that are from the Yoruba. I don't know if I'm saying this correctly, but the Yoruba African, basically it's a dye method that they use with a paste. They used indigo dye. And every image means something specific and special. And so when I did this wall for him, and actually my husband helped too, we often work together. When I did this wall for him, every single one of those tiles meant something, because I kind of felt like if you're going to do something, it ought to be sort of a group well-wishing prayer, you know? And anyone that comes in that room knows that there are just 60 well wishes on that wall. They may not know what they mean, but that's what it is. Yeah.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap up right there. We could go on and on and on. Please quickly tell us a website where they can find you at.
Yeah, absolutely. AnnNickelDavis.com. AnnNickelDavis.com.
Very good. Well, Davis. We appreciate you coming.
Ooh,
okay. Well, we'll also have it linked on our website. Ann, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air. That's Ann Davis. Well, head of production while on furlough from Theater at the Center and doing many, many other things. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. I hope I run into you soon.
Yeah.
Bye, Esther. Take care.
You too.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air the DK Devils. They preserve history in the forefront of adventures of community outreach. They look for rehabilitation of projects in Northwest Indiana. They play an active role in restoring abandoned buildings and doing many things. With us is the president, Tyrell Anderson, and vice president of DK Devils, Lori Gonzalez. Welcome to Art on the Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Aloha. Hello.
Well, my first question is, we want to hear maybe a little bit about your personal journey. So we'll start with you, Tyrell. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got from where you grew up, where you went to school, how you got from where you are to where you were to where you are now.
So Gary's home, born and raised, graduated from West Side High in 2003, went down to Purdue Lafayette, majored in civil engineering, found out I wasn't right for that field, switched over to industrial technology, finished there, worked for Edie's for little Nestle for a few years, and ended up back here in Gary working for U.S. Steel 2 years later. Somehow ended up back at home. That wasn't the plan, but that's how it ended up working out for me.
Very good. And go ahead, tell us a little bit about your background, Lori.
I also was born and raised in Gary. I kind of moved out of Gary once my kids got to school age, and then we lived in different places. I went to Lewallis High School, graduated, went to IUN, then moved away, then finished up at IUPUI and graduated with a liberal arts degree, majored in sociology, minored in psychology. And I've had all types of jobs. Right now I work at Ford Motor Company, and then, you know, we do DK Devils.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the history of the DK Devils as we move off of that. What was the inspiration for it? I assume you both were founding members.
Yes. Our organization, we were based off of our love for photography and just being creative individuals. So I started out doing film. I met Lori doing a couple of film projects. And once I met a few other people, Mickey, she's one of our founders, we started going to more abandoned places and just taking pictures and being fascinated by the structures. And I remember giving Lori a random call saying, hey, we're going to a school. You should come with us.
Actually, wait. You were like, do you want to go explore? And I'm like, explore what? Sure. Why not? You know, and that's how I kind of jumped in. I didn't even have a camera at that time. And then I was just like, without a camera, and I couldn't capture anything, which sucked. But just being able to go in those buildings and see like this leftover life was amazing to me. And then that drew me in. And then I ended up getting a camera not too long after that.
So that was around 2012, 2013. We were just taking pictures. And as more people gravitated towards us, we became official, non-official. We were just traveling the states, you know, whatever we can do in a quick road trip.
Yeah.
In 2015, the name kind of gravitated towards us and we stuck with the name.
So, yeah, we actually got jackets and had patches made and that said our name before we actually became official.
No, that was 2013.
Yeah.
And then 2015, Andrea, she's another founder, she suggested, hey, we should do something more. We should try to, because we were already doing community cleanups and stuff like that. And she suggested that we should try to do our own initiative as a nonprofit. So that's when we did the 501, she did the 501c3 paperwork and pushed that through and we became an official nonprofit from there.
Excellent.
So what was your first project? Because I love how you phrase it. You know, you came together for the love of art and adventure, and those two really pair well together. So was the art part only photography at first? Or because, you know, as you go through Gary, it's like filled with beautiful murals. And so is that part of?
No, and a lot of that stemmed from different projects, but our initial focus was just the photography. So when we got started and no one really wanted to work with a Decay Devil because it has devil in it.
Our name.
And we all have tattoos and a lot of people were just, you know, not sure of our direction. A lot of our initial fundraisers were based around us selling our art, our photography from not just Gary, but our travels across the U.S.,
I don't think we fit the profile. We kind of wore like hoodies that said I play in abandoned buildings, like black hoodies. And I just think that maybe we didn't look approachable. And I don't think people realized, hey, we're all adults with degrees and we're intelligent. You know, they just looked at us like, oh, they're kind of edgy. We don't know what they're about, you know. So
yeah, a lot of our initial efforts to raise funds were based around our art. We would sell our art. We would do whatever until we started receiving grant funding. You know, we were doing those type of things based around our art to fuel our projects. And, but the Union Station was not our first project attempt, I guess I should say. Yeah. We tried to do some work with the Gary Public Schools. We wanted to actually do Luwales Horseman, and it was Luwales and Horseman for sure. Yeah. We wanted to, since we knew how to get into the buildings, we had a pitch where, hey, we could help you guys board up and secure your schools free of charge.
And take out everything of value that another school could use, because a lot of those schools left a lot of things that other schools could use.
A lot of brand new books, a lot of brand new tables, you name it.
Anything like that, we were like, well, we can repurpose that, you know.
And that was shot down for a year. Yeah. Consistently until we were able to do our Union Station project.
Yeah. So were you responsible? Because I know in Gary, especially because people were going into, and not always safely, into a lot of the abandoned places, that they came up with a program with a fee, that you could pay a fee and go in to photograph. Were the Decay Devils part of that?
We were not a part of that. Our main goal was to just help preserve what was there, because when we were going to the buildings, there were still trophies from the 50s and 60s. There were still band uniforms. There were high school graduation photos from the 20s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
Diplomas from the 20s. So, like, those are the things that we wanted to help preserve, because
even artwork.
Yeah, even artworks. Because our vision was, it might not be on the table now, but in the future, and if a museum does pop up, there are so many things that are sitting in these vacant spaces that can be put on display that we see when we travel, you know, to various cities, and we wanted to be able to just preserve that information.
So where are they archived now? What were you able to?
We did not get the opportunity.
Yeah, they didn't give us permission.
And so that was the
thing. Okay. It's so valuable. It's hard to understand.
And that's the part that was kind of frustrating for us, because once we did the switch over to the nonprofit, a lot of the risk taking that we were doing, we had to stop, because you didn't want to put any bad name on the nonprofit or the city. That's the last thing I want to see is Decay Devils caught doing blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And stealing. But then they gave the stuff that they stole away to another school. It just would have been kind of bad, like a bad rep for us, even if we were trying to do good.
Right.
But we try to get permission to do things now.
What were some of the buildings you started with, like in Gary, and before you went out nationwide?
Well, we all came under the umbrella mainly because of City Methodist. Yeah. That was what brought us all together. Mm-hmm. Even when we would go out to, you know, venture to other places, we would all meet at City Methodist first. It was almost like a safe haven.
It's our home base.
It's like our home. You see so many creative people there from all walks of life, from all parts of the country, just walking the streets there to take pictures. And so City Methodist Horseman was a big one. The schools were definitely big, mainly for me, because a lot of the schools I've never set foot in. So my first time ever seeing Lew Wallace, it was closed. And that
I
was
thought what, you played sports.
I ran track. That's what I said.
I'm like, I was in all of them because I played volleyball. So like we had to go to all of them. So I remember the gyms a lot.
So yeah, when Lew Wallace closed and they were getting ready to prep for the auction, that was my first time I ever set foot in the school. And I remember telling Lori, like, this school is in perfect condition. There was nothing visibly wrong with the school. And it's just unfortunate that, I mean, we understand why things are the way they are, but it's like, man, you hate to see something that's in really great condition, you know, just kind of
not be repurposed for, right. And there's such a great need. There's such a great need for space to be repurposed and compassionate ways.
So tell us, like, if someone was interested in, first of all, just going to these buildings to photograph things. I'm a photographer myself. What's the procedure? Do you just go, or do you want to check in with the city or something like that?
People do. You can get permits. That's not how we started.
Right.
I mean, honestly, the first time I ever, when I first moved back to Gary, I was doing film. I had just finished like my first short film in Fort Wayne, and I moved back here. I was doing videos, and I remember calling my family saying, hey, it's this real cool church. I need security. I need all you guys to come up here, and, you know, and we got every blunt object that we could, and we went into City Methodist, and it was a culture shock for me because, number one, the day we went in, the church was full. There was someone on a band practicing their drums. There was someone in, it's like a foyer area. They were modeling dresses, a full-blown photo shoot in the cathedral. There was a band doing the photo shoot for their album cover. And I was just kind of taken back, like, it's people in here who want to create just like me. So that just piqued my interest and changed my mind big time. And we just, you know, just being creative. So I want to take pictures. I want to do this. It went from being creative to what's the history behind these buildings. And it just continued to, you know, build and build and build momentum. And yeah, that was how my base started. Just I want to go and check a spot and see if it's good enough to film to where we are today. It's wild.
Just real out of curiosity, since I'm a photographer, but we do have photographers that listen to the show, what kind of equipment do you use when you go in there?
I only shoot with Sony. I shoot with Sony everything.
He influenced me, so we're just team Sony over
okay.
here.
Okay.
But my leaning towards Sony was, that was what my original filming equipment was.
Right.
With. And so when I switched over to, I was like, well, filming is hard to raise money, but I can take pictures and, you know, get some of my money for my film projects. For me, it was like, well, I'll just keep everything compatible with the same company.
Do you have interchangeable lenses from your still cameras and your video?
No, I actually stopped filming. So, okay.
So
because it turns out I'm a better photographer than filmmaker.
Well, I'm a Canon shooter, and one of the nice things Canon did with their series of is made their professional series lenses compatible with their video equipment too. So,
oh, that's good.
Yeah. So
I bought one professional camera, and when I got it was already obsolete. And from there, I decided to film everything with my cameras, and the interchangeable lenses makes life very beautiful when you are a creative person. But what turned me off from filming is editing. I have no bone in my body that wants to sit down and edit film. I can edit pictures all day, but film is a whole nother nightmare for me.
It's a tough thing. Yeah, I know. So we talked about projects in Gary. Where else have you gone in the country to do this type of thing with the Decay Devils?
Where haven't we gone? We started out just doing 4-hour road trips. So our first pit stop was
Detroit in 2012, December of 2012, I'd like to add, because it was so cold and it was snowing.
And everyone kept equating Detroit to, hey, it's just a bit Gary.
Oh, God. And then there was so many bad things that they said about it.
And once we got to Detroit, it was like, this place is awesome. People were nice. You can see the development of the city. You can see a lot of the vacant buildings starting to come down. And we didn't have anything bad to say about Detroit when we left, other than, like, it was cold.
Even the homeless people spoke, you know, everybody, and said, hey, how you doing?
Everybody,
you know,
was,
like, it was not bad at all.
You can tell we were from out of town. Everyone treated us as though we were family. And that was, I can never say anything bad. We go to Detroit probably once a year, minus this year because of Corona.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's always been very loving people to us, you know. And from there, it was like, cool, what's next? And
then,
we did Cleveland. We drove down to New Orleans. We went through Kentucky.
So tell us, like, when you come into a city, what is it that you are doing and looking for?
We research first to see what is there, you know, what historical buildings that may have been neglected. We want to see those buildings. And so when you go into a city, we initially already have a plan of some sort, you know, to see, you know, where these buildings are and what condition they're in.
And as we grown, I want to say Kentucky changed me for sure, because we went to go eat at we needed Wi-Fi. This is before internet's where it had good service on your phone. And we went to go to McDonald's to use their Wi-Fi, and their drive-thru was, the inside was closed for remodeling, and only the drive-thru was open. So we ate at this hole-in-the-wall breakfast spot, and it was absolutely amazing. Probably one of the best breakfasts I ever had, and, you know, top three of everywhere I've ever eaten. And so what we started to do from there was like, okay, cool, what are some good eateries? What are some good museums? What are the things that the locals do? Let's immerse ourselves in the culture. So we began to shift, you know, as the years went on, we used to just go to abandoned buildings and go back to the hotel.
I didn't even pack anything nice. It was just like, pack some old shoes, old clothes, because we're going to get dirty. And then when we did the transition, we actually experienced, you know, whatever place we were at.
And that kind of changes your viewpoint of the entire landscape, because you see everything from their past, their present, and their future. You get to experience that city as a whole. You get to learn about those individuals as a whole. And it allows you to respect their landscape a lot more. So I'm glad that we had those opportunities to, like, just really go and immerse ourselves in. This is where the locals go shop. We go buy. I mean, we went to Seattle. We went and bought food. We went and cooked breakfast for each other. We really immersed ourselves in, okay, this is the marketplace. This is, we're going to stay out of the hotels now. We go get Airbnbs.
Yeah,
we,
right.
You know, so we really changed that mentality of, let's just hit abandoned places, to let's go learn everything that this place has to offer.
I think it became more about community than just buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So who would you reach out to at first? So did you have somebody who you had already set up, like, contact with, and you did your research? But when you head to these cities, is somebody there saying hello?
It depends on the city. So some cities we just went out and did our thing. Other places like New Orleans, I remember Lori reached out to their Preservation Society, just asking those guys for assistance, because not financial, but more so of a guidance. Because when we went down there it was probably 10 years after Katrina, we have a mindset on what New Orleans is going to look like. And it was absolutely amazing. It didn't look anything like what we thought. And I remember Lori reaching out to their society before we even took that trip. Lori didn't make the trip, but she talked to them, just asking them their process? You know, how did they bounce back? You know, what were some avenues that we can take, you know, on our end? And they were very receptive and, you know, talking with us. There are other, we get the most support from photographers, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. People who follow us on Instagram, when we see that we're going to their city and we already been talking for months, it's a lot easier to reach out to those individuals and say, hey, I'm coming into town. Are you free? If you're not free, do you have any suggestions? So social media is really our biggest, I guess, impactful place where we can just reach out to people almost automatically and just get some guidance on local places to visit, hidden places to visit, you know, what's the best food that's around to get that true experience when we go visit.
Right.
How many people are involved in the DK Devils?
Currently 14. The number fluctuates up and down over the years. It's I want to say the biggest hitter for us is we started being creatives and just loving to travel. As we did the transition to be a nonprofit, some of the people who were on board specifically to go travel, they were not on board for this nonprofit. We ended up losing some individuals.
The nonprofit was more like work, you know, and building something opposed to just having fun. Taking pictures and traveling is fun.
Right.
But
Nonprofit is work.
Yeah, it's work.
It's a lot of work.
Is there a membership? Like if people want to join the DK Devils, do you have like a membership fee? Or,
yes. Or so just, like the base level membership is $60.
That's a year, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You get a t-shirt and you get like first dib invites on trips and we call them our team building events, our team building days. And the membership levels, there's a whole tier system online, but the base level, that's what it gets you. It gets you a shirt and just gets you into like some behind the scenes stuff. And when we decide we want to go get dirty again, you get those special invites as a group member.
So how is the pandemic affecting DK Devils and you personally within that?
Well, it pretty much canceled everything in the beginning of the year and mid-year. I think our first official event might have been August when we had some artists come out and paint at Union mm-hmm. Station. So we had a
placemaking online event.
No, not that. I'm talking about what we had to cancel with the Chernobyl.
Oh, so we had an event called the Rust Belt Takeover.
There you go, Rust Belt Takeover.
And this was in partnership with the
Young
Preservation Coalition. Their name is super long. Rust Belt Coalition of Young Preservationists. They're based out of Ohio. Their president is Sarah Marson. She has been a very, very, very good friend to us in our journey mm-hmm. As a nonprofit. So we were going to have over 200 individuals come to Gary and essentially be DK Devils for a weekend.
From all over, like other states, they come and this would, I don't know how many years she's been doing it, but I think she...
This would have been the fourth year.
The fourth year. So these were people that have already been on her trips. But what was so cool about it is they get to experience Gary and we got to set up what they experience. And mm-hmm. when I tell you, like, there was like the Chernobyl, we went to Chernobyl in 2019. When I tell you, like, me and Tyrell were on eBay trying to buy all this stuff from like the 80s and like from Ukraine. That was like my favorite part because we were going to showcase all these items and the pictures that we took at Chernobyl. And when it canceled, I mean, look, my heart was broken. I was like, no, I was really sad about that. But it was much more than just that. But that was my favorite part.
And the Chernobyl experience for us was great in comparison to our city because we had a certain expectation level when we got there.
Yeah.
Our expectation was we're going to see a bunch of hole in the grounds and it's going to be completely run down. And it was everything but. And so that was going to be that was like the opening event for that Rust Belt. Hey, this is our Chernobyl event. We have our version of the Ukraine food, the food from Ukraine. You're going to be able to immerse yourself in the culture and our pictures. We have music from Ukraine.
Yeah.
And we want to kind of showcase, this is what you think's going on over there. This is what actually is going on over there. And the same way that you hear negative comments about Gary, Indiana, these are the positive people who are putting things in place in this city to, you know, turn things around.
Yeah, it would mirror.
And it was the perfect, in my mind, the perfect, you know, launch event for that tour that we had to cancel. and that was going to be sponsored 100% by Indiana Landmarks. Sarah, she made some phone calls. She got the whole event financed. I'm like, man, I love you.
Yes.
So that cut down on the, everyone had to pay a fee to attend, but
I mean, think we were going to put it, it was between $30 and $50. We had some, you know,
but it had to be a lot higher, but she, by her getting it financed, completely cut down on the reservation cost. So it was like, man, you get food for 3 days,
yeah,
3 days of events, and you have to pay $20-$30. You can't beat that.
Yeah. So that was one of the biggest, the Rust Belt Tour was one of the biggest events that was canceled from Corona. And then
we canceled Love Fest too.
Oh gosh, Love Fest. I forgot about that. That was supposed to be in August, this past August. So that didn't happen. And then we also had to postpone our Capital Campaign launch. But I mean, we just launched that, so that's still okay. But I feel like when, like, this pandemic happened, it's kind of awkward to say, hey, support us, even though everyone's losing their jobs and you have to work around the whole fundraising and campaigning thing. But that was tough.
Well, we just have about a few seconds left. First of all, real briefly, what are you looking forward to after the pandemic? And then give us your website, Facebook, and how to get a hold of you guys.
Across the board, everything is Decay Devils. So website is decaydevils.org. Decay Devils on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Two words. Moving forward, we're pushing our capital campaign throughout the course of next year. And that's decaydevils.org/unionstation. You get to see our vision, what we anticipate the building to be. The big hitter for us is just stressing the point that we're not just preserving a building. Everything that we do is for the community, is for the people. And that's our vision. This building has brought so many people together for so many different walks of life, so many different backgrounds. We want to continue to push that forward.
Very good. Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. We've been talking to the DK Devils, President Tyrell Anderson and Vice President Lori Gonzalez. We appreciate you coming on the show and sharing with us about the DK Devils and their mission.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys.
And we'd like to thank our guests today for being on Art in the Air, which is heard every Friday at 11 a.m., rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m., and Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Your hosts are Larry Breckner and Esther Golden. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager, and Tom Maloney, Vice President, Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Underwriters for Art in the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum and Walt Breininger of Paragon Investments. Also, Mary Levan is our art patron supporter. Art in the Air is supported by the Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts-related event, exhibit, please email us at artontheair@gmail.com. That's artontheair@gmail.com. See you right here next week, 103.1 FM and 89.1 FM, Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know.